Welcome to the FinTech Scaling Show. This podcast is sponsored by Scale Up Consulting, helping FinTech startups create a scalable organization to support an ever-increasing demand. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@scaleupconsulting.co. Now, over to the show with Richard Doty, founder and host. Hi, folks, and welcome to another episode of the FinTech Scaling Show, where we talk to cutting-edge leaders and chat to them about how they are scaling and getting their insights on scaling. And why we're doing this is because we want to play a major role in creating and being part of the new FinTech ecosystem. So we want to give you the insights, the tactics, the strategies that allow you as a leader and as a founder to lead your team, your group, even your ecosystem, maybe part of society, into a prosperous future. And today, we are super excited to have Paolo on the show. Paolo is a co-founder and CPO at Celerify. Paolo's got an extremely interesting background. He's worked at Google, done a stint there for, I think, 10 or so years. He's then jumped out of that and been a mentor and advisor in the startup world for a number of years, and obviously also is leading the charge at Celerify. So super excited to have you on the show today, mate. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Brilliant. And just to give you some insights into what we're going to be chatting about today, we're going to be diving deep into planning and strategic planning. And why are we doing this? Well, it's important as leaders and founders of businesses to really be the cause rather than the effect. So the cause, making certain that you have a plan, you're pushing forward on that plan, and that's going towards your vision. If you're not and you're the effect, well, you're waiting and sitting back and waiting for things to happen. So we're going to dive into the subject today and kick off with, it would be good to get your insights, Paolo, on how you define strategic planning.
Yes, that's like a brilliant question. So this is something that I've learned like many years ago when I started my career actually in Google. Google as a company, as you guys know, like it has been developing many different products. And when you start developing so many different products, it's very important that you have a key focus on strategic planning because you might end up spreading yourself too thin. So generally speaking, the way I approach strategic planning is really like focusing on the next 5 years, thinking like at where I want to be, like as a company, as an individual, in 5 years from now. So let's say on September, in 5 years from now, I want to be here. And then trying to reverse engineer it to see the steps and the things that I need to take in order to reach that goal, either personally or career-wise.
Yeah.
And the way I break it down, it's using, again, coming from the background of Google, is using OKRs. So the OKRs for me is the best tool to really work out strategic planning. So that's usually the way I approach it, said, but personally and career-wise as well.
Okay, so the definition is coming up with a big ambition. Five years is a long time. Coming with a big ambition and being able to break that down into sizable chunks that allows us as leaders to actually action this stuff.
Absolutely. Because psychologically, also it's important to have like a long-term vision.
Yeah.
But the long-term vision, if it's too ambitious and like you don't break it down into smaller chunks or units of work, might create a paradox of like decision paralysis in the sense that it is too far away, too big for you, and you feel like it's impossible to achieve. It's the same thing as climbing Mount Everest. If you look at the summit, they say, I need to be there in 5 days. You will be overwhelmed, even though you know that you have that direction of going up to Mount Everest to the summit. But then if you start breaking down and say, okay, my plan is in the next day, I'm going to be at 200 meters, in the following day, and so on. Then it feels like, so in a way, you still have the sense of direction, your North Star, but it's way easier to tackle it, right? By having these smaller chunks, so you need to work.
Yeah, I like to call this, you're causing things to happen.
Yes.
You're day by day, week by week, month by month, you're stacking and you're going forward to that Everest, that North Star or that strategic plan that you or vision that you had.
Absolutely.
And if you look at that vision and then you're breaking it down, how do you as a leader Yeah, this is a big one, right? How do you as a leader, and then maybe one level below, as a team leader, motivate yourself and your team to consistently strive towards that Everest, that North Star, and that sort of strategic vision?
I'm a big fan of democracy, generally, and leadership through democracy.
100%. So when you say leadership through democracy, what do you mean by that?
So what I mean by that is that, so when I look at the 5 years plan, right? So if I say, like, I come up with this 5 years plan myself without really consulting and getting the team to participate in the strategic planning, then nobody's going to be behind that mission, right? But if that strategic planning happens via democracy, and again, in democracy, you still have a prime minister or a president, or whatever you want, but still it's democratic decision. Mm. It will be way easier and better to actually motivate people to reach that stretch goal. And that's the reason why I think OKRs are key in this specific approach, because OKRs are a great communication tool to let you involve people in the decision-making process and then keep people accountable, including yourself, right? Mm. As I said, there's always a prime minister in the sense that, for example, in the case of our company, Stratify, we do have investors, we do have KPIs, which are like, in a way, set via external or for external stakeholders, right? Mm-hmm. For us to be sustainable as a company, mm-hmm. which these are things that in most of the cases are like, have very little room for negotiation. But then how are we going to achieve them? That's a discussion that we can have internally as a team. Mm-hmm. And if you have that discussion early on, then you can really have everyone behind the mm-hmm. mission, right? There is like a very good quote, like from, I think it was from Marty Kagan in Inspired, I think in the book called Inspired, if I remember correctly, is that adding a team of missionaries rather than mercenaries, right? So you need people to believe in the mission rather than being just there for the paycheck, right?
So the motivation is not monetary, it's not the dollar sign. Rather, the motivation from a team perspective is there willingness to be part of the journey because they've been involved in it.
Absolutely. It's like feeling that, I think this is like a pattern that we all experience, right? In any job, that the financial reward of any job is important to a point, right? You know, like, you know, I think it was the Markov pyramid or something that was called. I don't remember now exactly. I think it was the Markov pyramid of the basic needs of like a human being, right? So once you cover those with your financial reward, which is food, shelter, and some other stuff, like then what makes you stick to a job and like, and do the extra mile is really the motivation that you have in participating in the decision making of that job, product, business, right? And that's the reason why I always suggest when I advise startups from the very beginning, always to have this democratic type of approach in decision-making strategic planning.
So you in effect saying there's motivation, but just come back to the start of the show, we're saying cause and effect. So as a leader, you're motivating yourself and your teams, but you're delegating cause to your team because you're coming up with a way to achieve your strategy together. So that motivates people because as we said at the start, you sort of want to be cause, you want to be pushing together as an individual, as a team, as a group.
Absolutely. And really to that point, one great advantage of having this sort of like crowdsourcing of the strategy, so to say, is that obviously 10 brains, 20 brains are way more powerful than one, right? Yeah. And even if I am like the CPO of a company and I have like a bunch of experience or CEO of a company, still, I really hope that in my team, there are people smarter than me, way smarter than I am, and that will actually flag and suggest things that I didn't even think about. So that's the power of like democracy in that sense, right? In strategic planning by a democracy.
So you're opening up yourself as a leader again. You're opening up yourself to different ideas, different strategies, different ways of achieving that vision, that five-year vision that we spoke about.
Absolutely. It's the same thing. Like I like to use this parallel, like this analogy with the open source software. Yeah. In a way, you're like opening up your source code to the team. And by doing that, you actually have a lot of like useful feedback and input.
And when you're going through this process, let's take it, you know, you're leading your team through this process. Let's sort of take an example, right? maybe it's at Google, maybe it's with the guys now, maybe it's with the startups that you advise, and you walking them through the strategic planning process over the next, you know, say 12 months, let's say 12 months, make it simple for everyone to sort of understand. What are the critical parts of planning that you need to get right in order to achieve that first step, that 12-month step?
Absolutely. I would say that the key pillars in the strategic planning, and I'm approaching it always from a product angle, right? So whatever company I'm advising, working with, and so on, I always try to push them into the product idea, because whatever we build is always a product, right? Yes, you can call it service, it's the same. So how do you do the strategic planning? The key thing to me is starting from the customer problem. So what is the customer problem that we want to address in the next 12 months, 5 years, be it whatever time frame it is, and how we're going to generate financial, let's call it business value for us as a company. And the business value in most of the cases is financial value. So how are we going to generate revenue? But it can also be that, you know, like, I don't know, we want to be extremely visible from a branding point of view, or, you know, we're working on a different mission and so on, right? So this is the first step. It's really understanding what is the thing that we're tackling as a customer problem and how we're going to generate business value out of it. So already this, to answer these two first questions takes quite a bit of research, because you need to speak to customers, you need to understand what is the thing that you're addressing, and like how you're going to generate like this customer value, right? For them and then for us as a company. Once you nail down that,
just quickly, because I think it's a good, and sorry to interrupt you, you mentioned that the first step takes a bit of research.
Yeah.
So if you could just give a bit of insight into maybe two or three things that you need to do in order to complete that research.
Absolutely. So this is what you would call a product discovery phase, but to me it's broader. It's more like a business discovery at that point, much more than a product.
Yeah.
But in the industry, it's called product discovery normally. So the way you can do this is very simple, okay? So you have like certain assumptions regarding customer problems. So let's say that I am researching, I'm building a company. I have a company that is addressing, let's say, a customer problem, which is, I don't know, like financial health, right? You know, financial fitness. Okay. So we are tackling a customer problem that is people are getting more and more in debt every day.
Mm.
Okay. So this is like our assumption. So we do think, as a company, backed by some research that we did online, just by looking up things. And this would take 3-4 days just to kind of like nail down some assumptions and think about a customer problem, right, that we want to tackle. After we do this initial preliminary, let's say, self-analysis, then we go off and talk to potential customers. So people that are like, we think that they have that problem. Mm. And go through like questions with them to understand if the problem that we think exists really exists.
Mm.
And these, there are different techniques of doing this, right? You can ask like open-ended questions, more specific questions. There are like there's plenty of research and tools out there to do this type of interviews.
Yeah.
Interviews could be phone calls, could be questionnaires online, could be like many different ways. But in a way, this is like an early stage testing of like our customer problem assumptions. Mm. And these shouldn't take more than a couple of days, right? Mm. To complete all the interviews and collect all the intelligence out of it, the analytics. After that, we have a clear understanding of what the customer problem is, or at least we have some clear assumptions about it. And then we think about the solution. And to think about the solution, my approach is usually like via design sprints. I'm not doing the full cycle of design sprints, the 5 days, but I'm just doing the first day, which is basically you're mapping out the different steps and potential solutions.
Okay.
With that, we pinpoint what in the next 12 months out of the customer journey we're going to do, thinking about the North Star, which is the end state, and maybe in the 12 months we can tackle only one of the circles there. And that, with that, we have a customer problem and we have a potential solution that we're going to be working on in the next 12 months. And then we break it down.
Nice. Okay, brilliant. Thanks for providing some insights. Okay, so that's step one. And once we unpack step one for you, so on to step two now.
So after that, after we get this customer problem and potential solution mapped out, then we start the breaking down into like a strategy, right? So we talked about 12 months. Then we look at, you know, OKR's definition. As a team, we gather, we have like a session. And usually the way you do this is like, at least in a startup of like 20 people, you can literally have a meeting and discuss this. In a larger organization with like, let's say hundreds of people, you have to break it down, which means that usually you work with the head of the departments. So say we have this customer problem, I would work with the head of product, head of technology, head of sales, head of like so on, to discuss and have this strategic session to define this, what would be called a top line OKR, which is 3-4 OKRs that you have as a company for the next 12 months to address that customer problem and achieve that business value generation. After that session, which it's literally like a day, even less, probably half a day, then you have a clear strategy for the next 12 months. Next step is for each department, as I said, in a larger organization, to take these, let's say, top-line OKR that they have and break it down into quarterly OKRs themselves, assigning objective and key results, owners, and so on.
Yeah.
And then you work it through.
Okay, cool. And then once this is all done, how do you monitor the ongoing performance of the plan across departments?
Absolutely. So let's look at the case of the larger organization, because small organizations is way easier. Larger organization, generally speaking, what you would call an OKR rhythm is in setting up the OKRs on a quarterly basis. And as you said, monitoring the effectiveness of those OKRs at least 3 times in a quarter, which means at the beginning of the quarter when you set them up, in the middle of the quarter, and at the end of the quarter. And throughout this process, you rate your performance against those objectives and key results. So again, the way you would do it in a large organization is that at department level, the head of the organization would have these, let's say, 3 meetings at the beginning of the quarter, in mid-quarter, end of the quarter with his staff to discuss like the performance of the OKR, so how you're doing. So one key thing here is that is important to remember is that OKRs are not a performance management tool. So OKRs are a communication tool and a way for us to make sure that we are doing the right thing to achieve that end goal, that North Star. But if there is somebody owning an objective or a key result that is not performing, we really need to make sure that we are not coupling immediately that with performance management.
Let's bring it down to the engine room now, because this is this stuff. There's a strategy. There's the OKRs. We split it out into departments. On a day in, day out basis, what are you doing as a leader, and what is the leadership group doing to make certain that gradiently, day by day, week by week, you are moving towards that 12-month target? And what I'm not, you know, you're not going to be chasing people up and go, listen, Sally, have you finished that piece of code? But is there, what I'm looking for, is there an approach to helping the team organize themselves such that they are moving forward as we all want them to move forward?
Yes, absolutely. This is actually like one of those questions that often comes up when I'm like working with startups and helping them set up OKRs. It's like, how are we going to do it? There is one framework which I used, and I learned actually like in my career many years ago, which is called conversation feedback and recognition or reward, CFR. So what that means is you're not going to chase Sally every day like, have you done your homeworks, right? Have you done like your piece of code? Have you developed your piece of code? But you as a leader, which in most of the cases you're also a people manager, you need to constantly engage with your team. So how do you keep track of things happening, right? How do you make sure that people are delivering on the work like that they do, that they're supposed to do based on the OKRs? So the first thing is like empowering them, and really empowering them and trusting them. That when you look at this mission, as we discussed, the 12 months mission, and they really feel they're part of it, the motivation actually will go higher than just something cascading on their desk that they have to do, right? So that's like one thing which I think is the foundation. Mm. Then from a management point of view, with the conversation, feedback, and recognition approach, you as a leader, you have to weekly meet with your staff members, all of them, spending at least half an hour a week with them, discussing these things. Mm. So it won't be like, Sally, did you write the code as we discussed? It's more like, Sally, what is the progress that you made against that OKR that we have for this quarter? Yeah. What is blocking you from doing your, from completing it? Mm. How can I help you? Mm. What are the things that, you know, like you're more worried about? What are your concerns? Mm. And having that conversation, the C, where actually you have a feedback session, the F, where Sally will give you feedback and saying like, by the way, like this OKR was poorly written, or I'm dependent on these other things that are not moving. Can you help me? But also you can provide feedback as a leader and say, okay, I think Sally, you should probably look at this thing in a different way. And then at the end of the quarter, there is the R, which is the recognition or reward, which is not necessarily financial reward or recognition, but could also be part of that, right? So that's the way you will manage it, like on the floor, I would say.
And what about as a leader yourself, taking away the team for a second? So the team's moving, Sally's doing a job well. If there's a Sally there, we do like you. Don't worry about it. What do you do on a day-in, day-out basis? How do you organize your world so you as the CPO, the co-founder, you moving your stuff forward?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm going to talk about the way I do it, right? And I think it's working well, at least. So the way I usually do this is like, obviously you are, as a leader, you can be distracted in your mission as a leader by many different things, right? Yeah. It's a bit like Ulysses, like going through the sirens. And in a way, you have to become deaf to distractions, but also you can't be numb to external input. So this is like something which is like a tricky balance that you need to strike there and learn how to. So what I mean with that is, for you as a leader, you have a clear strategy ahead of you, which is in your OKRs, right? Your OKRs are defined as a leader, as a company, as a business unit. And in a way, you might also, you could say, anything that is not in my OKRs, I'm not listening to, I'm not paying attention to. But this is a big fallacy in the sense that there might be external feedback and external input that actually is telling you that those OKRs are wrong. So this is like a fine art, a fine balance of saying, this is my direction and strategy, but I also need to be open to external input. So you need to, and this is something that you actually unfortunately learn with experience, in learning what is, let's say, like a mirage, like an illusion, versus what is important to listen to. The way I do it, which is a very simple way of like understanding if something is a real or a distortion in a way, is using like a cost-benefit analysis. So when something, let's say I have my strategy and I have my 3 points in my strategy of things I need to work in the next 12 months. Something new comes up. I simply do a cost-benefit analysis with 100 points to be assigned to the cost, between the cost and the benefit. And if the cost is higher than the benefit, I simply don't do it.
Oh, so a bit analytical going into it and then taking a look at the different parts of the problem statement in this case.
Yes. And this is something, a very simple tool that, and I think it's called the Eisenhower matrix, which is the return and investment. So it's like 4 quadrants where you put return and investment in 2 axes. Mm. And if something is like high return, high investment, you might think about it. If it's basically low return, low investment, again, you work out these 4 quadrants, and with the cost benefit analysis, that can help you a bunch to understand if something you should look more into or not. Mm. In any case, even if it's like something that you want to look into, I always suggest people not to jump straight into it, but again, go through the same process of customer problem, solution, understanding all of this before saying we drop it and we do that.
Yeah. And also there's another dynamic here, right? So I get there's things that are always coming into your inbox. Let's call it that. There's stuff that's constant pressures, either internal pressures or external pressures. And I like what you say. You can't be numb from it, but you also have to be, in a way, very strategic as to how you change your battle plan. Let's call it that. Because your battle plan needs to be done on a daily basis. You need to have blocks of things that you're going to be doing in your calendar on a daily basis for any output to happen. Because otherwise, again, just coming back to when we first started, even on a daily basis, you can drop into the bucket of effect if you aren't managing and planning out your day as a leader. You'll start taking in all the stuff from your inbox and start fiddling around on LinkedIn or Facebook, and then there's no output, right? So I'd like to just get a bit more insight as to what you do to make certain that the distractions are understood and taken in, but your daily plan, your daily worksheet, your daily to-do list, whatever we want to call it, is really, you execute it. You're the cause of that.
So I think there are two aspects there, right? The first aspect is the self-productivity.
Yeah.
And the other one is like understanding the external environment, right? So like, as we discussed before, regarding the understanding the external environment, an analytical approach, as we described, like the cost-benefit analysis and, you know, this matrix of like high investment, high return type of thing could help.
Yeah.
But you need to be mindful of not ending up in a decision paralysis where the analytical thinking doesn't make you take bold decisions, right? So in a way, you can spend a lot of time in any matter on life doing analysis. But sometimes there are things that you don't know, you simply don't know, and you need to trust your own judgment and take a risk, right? Knowing that you're taking a risk. So this is like one thing to kind of moderate the external input. Then from a personal productivity point of view, let's say personal focus point of view, I really loved the, I don't know if you heard of this book called Deep Work. It's a great book. And that helped me a lot, really structuring my day and my work to be the most effective. So generally speaking, I'm not the type of person constantly on emails. I don't have my email like always switched on. Actually, I don't check emails so frequently. I check them like, I try to check, I don't know, 2-3 times per day. We use Slack as a communication tool, but again, I'm not like constantly on Slack. So I usually use my calendar in a way that I block units of work when I need to do things. And I'm not available. I'm completely offline. So if there is an emergency, somebody can call me. They have my phone number, but I'm not on Slack. I'm not on WhatsApp. I'm not answering emails and all of that. And this allows me to really do the work that I need to do, right? And achieve that mission that I have.
Yeah, that's perfect. And how has this helped you having that structure? Just personally, how has that helped you as you've grown your businesses? And also, obviously, your outside activities, because you are an advisor to advisor and mentor to other startups.
So that helped me a lot structuring. So what I would say is that let's use the example of before I was using this approach, right? Before I was using this approach, I ended up working like crazy amount of hours and being extremely tired and not so effective. Whereas when I started using this approach of blocking units of time in my calendar and really being strict with that, that helped me to give me the opportunity to take on additional things within my company, but also with advisory and so on, without increasing exponentially the amount of hours I work. So I do have a good, I would say even the work-life balance is like, I think is an obsolete concept, but I don't work like 12 hours a day, never. I think in a day, if I work 6-7 hours is like a must. That's my brain capacity. I can't work more than that. Yet I'm CPO of a startup. I'm advising another startup. I actually have a restaurant with my girlfriend. And I also do like mentorship in a number of different programs, which take time. And I do this simply by focusing on important things and using my calendar as my tool, right? And having like a routine, like after, for example, after 6 p.m., I'm not like working. After 7 p.m. usually, I'm not working. So I'm not checking emails. I'm not following any of that. On my phone, I don't have Slack. The emails are not synced. And these are all things that allow you also to give me brain space to then be more effective. Because what I've realized with time is that I like doing sports, right? I like doing boxing and all of that. And with any sport, the training time is as important as the resting time. So if you're constantly on, you're less effective. It's inevitable.
Yeah. Listen, some excellent points there, some very actionable points there. So routine, having those chunks in your diary, and also taking in outside perspectives, so sports, mentorship, etc., they can all fit in if you structure your days correctly. And I 300% agree with you, because I do exactly the same. We have battle plans, weekly battle plans, monthly battle plans, and daily battle plans. Because as you say, otherwise you stretch and you work into 12 o'clock every night, and you're not top of your game. I think that is an actionable nugget that everyone listening to the show today should take away. And if they're not doing it, start doing it, and let me know what the benefits are in the next 2 or 3 weeks. Just drop me a note. You got my email address. I'd love to hear from you. As we talked about adaptability, and we talked about the need to take in from the outside environment, although you have a plan and a vision, you also need to be aware that things change, and also change your plan accordingly at a point in time. So COVID is a classic example. Mm-hmm. How, if something, maybe we can take COVID as an example here, actually. When COVID hit and you did have a plan and you had that vision moving forward, what did you do to adapt that plan and also then not only adapt it, but get that team that we were speaking about early on in sync and then moving towards that next step and that new plan?
So the COVID example is also, to me, besides adaptability, is also the perfect example to show how you can do as much analysis as you want, but there are things which will happen which are beyond your control, right?
100%.
So this is like a key thing that, I have learned, not just with COVID, but generally, there are things that you can control and things that you can't control.
Yeah.
In personal life, in business, and so on. So the best way, to me, to adapt to that is simply accepting that paradigm, that the things might happen that I can't control. And so, in a way, striking a good balance between planning risk management and just being a bit loose. So that gives you, so that's exactly what I mean with the strategy as well, right? So if you have a strict strategy built, like if you look at the old school, like let's call it old school, more, let's say more established industries or like different than tech industries, the strategic planning is usually very lengthy, takes months. It's like 60 pages documents and multiple people, consultants paid for that. And it costs millions to a company, right? Then what happens? COVID strikes and you're like,
damn. Can't do anything.
Exactly. Fuck. Like you spent 60 million, like, now you're going to keep, like with this strategy because, like we spent so much time and money on this and we don't know any better.
Yeah.
But if you have like a lean strategy, if you have an agile strategy that you build literally like at most in a week by observing, doing, and quickly drafting, then COVID hits. Like your things are, you adapt. It's as simple as that. You just redo the same process a week and done. That's exactly what happened to my company and some of the companies I advised. Like they had to figure out, okay, yeah, sure, we need to go remote. Fine, we'll figure it out. So that adaptability, it's like more of a mindset than like a risk mitigation or risk strategy type of approach. It's like saying, okay, we're lean, we learn from the world is ever changing, and we'll have to adapt.
I like it. Like it a lot. And as you look forward into the future, what factors are you guys considering and what questions are you asking as a leadership as you move forward and you grow up and you scale to different countries and different parts of the world?
That's actually, that's very timely because we're going through that process now as we are going internationally with our company and product. So the way we approach, so again, this is something that I've learned in my previous life as an employee of a very large company. Strategic planning for internationalization, to me, follows the same footstep of general strategic planning. Yeah. So if we look at the case of Certify, we're looking at certain markets to go and launch in the next 12 months. And these markets are one of the first markets that we're going to be tackling is Italy in the next 6 months. So how we approach the internationalization and growth from that angle? Very simply, again, same story. We went on, we tried to understand from a KPI point of view, do they need our solution in Italy? The same people that we're talking to in Hungary, would they need the same type of people, same persona, would they need like this solution? The answer, like from a data point of view, it is yes, from a KPI point of view. Now let's talk to them. Let's ask them some questions. Would they be interested in this solution? Yes. Okay, that's good. So now let's plan it. What is the best solution for Italy? Because obviously a product needs to be customized according to the market needs. Okay, so let's define this product. Let's build it up. Let's try to talk to our customers early on before we build it. Let's get some feedback. And with that, we follow the same approach. And again, like that's what I learned in Google, in my experience, and tends to work. It's actually quite simple. Yeah. Like it's not that difficult. And the key thing that, you know, like I tend to suggest to startups when they go internationally is find your customers before you go there. So by doing this product discovery, you already talk, like in our case, we talk with financial institutions, large employers, which are the, let's say, the paying customer, right, of our product. We go talk to them. And it's unbelievable, like the people that you can reach out by CEOs of large entities, large companies, just by sending an email and telling them, like, look, I'm doing some product discovery research. I would love to know about the market. You have a bunch of experience. Do you mind having like a chat, 10 minutes? I'm not selling anything. I'm just doing research. It's unbelievable. Like you have like a response rate of like 80%.
Brilliant.
So it's a very simple thing, right? You know, like, but it works well. And then with that, you know, you can start developing your product and you already have customers.
Yeah, brilliant. And like we said, go and talk to your customers. Go find your customers before you jump into the ocean, right? Such an important point that we all need to be aware of and understand.
Absolutely.
And what's outside of this and outside of that, what we just spoke about, what's the one thing that you would highly recommend to listeners that are starting out and scaling up their businesses? And it could be on the personal side and also could be on the professional side. What's that one nugget of wisdom that you would like to give out to our listeners today?
So I will actually start with the professional, let's say with the business side and then with the personal side. The business side is, as I was mentioning just in the previous answer, talk to your customers. Whenever you want to launch to, like, say, you want to expand, let's say you're successful in the UK, doesn't mean that you're going to be successful in Germany. Before you, or vice versa, before you start an internationalization campaign, product development, go talk to the customers in the country. Understand if they have the same problems, if they want the same solution, what is the pricing point? All of these things you can simply answer by talking to the customers. And that's enough to talk to, depending in the industry, in the segment, in the B2B, it's enough that you talk to 10 potential customers. In the B2C, it's a bit bigger. So you can use surveys and all of that. But in any case, talk to your customers before you do anything. So that would be my advice from a business development point of view. From a personal development point of view, professional personal development point of view, that is like a fallacy that I, let's say a distortion that I often end up having, not just in work, but also in my personal life. We are all imperfect. You're going to make mistakes. That's inevitable. Just accept it. The fact that you know that you're going to make mistakes would actually absorb you from feeling this perfection paradox that creates even more anxiety and stress. Just drop it and learn.
Brilliant advice. I mean, I can't add to that because it's just brilliant. And I think today we've dived into some fantastic nuggets here around how to look at planning, how to take it from that big vision all the way down to actually starting to execute. So if you're listening today, re-listen to this, take notes, and start actioning this stuff. I want you guys and girls to action it, put it into play, get your battle plan up and running on a daily basis, spread that word through your teams. And if you have any questions on any part of this, drop me a note at richard@scaleupconsulting.co. I'm happy to answer them. And listen, Paula, it's been brilliant, absolutely brilliant episode today. Really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed diving into your knowledge and wisdom, and really appreciate you taking time today, mate.
Thanks a lot. We appreciate it. It was a great pleasure to be here.
Cool, mate. Great. And we'll look forward to catching up with everyone in the next episode.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot.